Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymyr Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymyrbaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, hello and welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymyr Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do indeed unpack three questions that were raised from Sunday's sermon. This past Sunday, we started a new series, the series that's going to kind of be our major biblical series over the course of the year, and that is a series in the book of Romans, a series that we've entitled Good News for All of Us, which kind of links a little bit with our theme for the year, working out our salvation together, but I also think really reflects essentially what the epistle to the Roman church is all about. We launched our series in Romans, and interestingly, I suppose, or noteworthily, it was noteworthy perhaps that we ended up starting at the end. So this was based on a book that I read by a fellow named Scott McKnight called Reading Romans Backwards, where he essentially argues that we need to understand who Paul was writing to and what he was concerned about. And that stuff's found at the end of the letter. And once we understand that, we are better able to understand the why of Paul's theology, or the doctrine that he has at the beginning of the book. It's the most systematic review of his understanding of the gospel that we find in any of his writings. And yet we so often treat it as a systematic outline of his theology rather than as a pastoral epistle, an epistle or a letter that had a pastoral concern to it, an issue that he wanted to address in the church. And so we began in chapter 16, looking at the kind of the last warning that Paul gives to them to be on their guard against people who cause division and put obstacles in your way. He's encouraged by their obedience, wants them to be innocent of or wise about what is good and innocent of what is evil. And then we also had a good look at the greetings in the beginning of chapter 16, where he greets 26 different people and up to five different house churches or small communities of faith that are in the Roman church. And he does that in order to demonstrate the unity that the gospel brings, because ultimately that's, I think that's what Paul is getting at, that the gospel is powerful, not just for salvation as individuals, but it's powerful because it unites people who have no business being united. And so there's a demonstration of that unity in that list where he jumbles up Jews and Gentiles and men and women and slaves and free. But there's also, I think, an inherent call and invitation to, shall I say, cross the aisle between those groups and to genuinely greet and welcome each other. I'll stop there lest I review the entire sermon by re-preaching it. But here are the questions that were raised from Sunday. So first, why haven't you preached through Romans before? So I did mention that I had never done that, and, you know, I suppose if I'd been preaching for 2 years, that wouldn't be that surprising, but I've been preaching for quite a long time now and have been here at the church for nearly 30 years, and so it's a little bit surprising that that's the case, so thought I might address that in brief. Secondly, what does Paul mean when he says to be wise about the good and innocent of the evil, in the church context especially? So Paul does pick up some language that I think is an allusion to the Jesus tradition when Jesus sends his disciples out on mission. And I think that's the key to understanding what's going on there. But we'll unpack that a bit. And then third, every divisive person recommends unity. Just agree with me. Paul does the same and rejects the heterodox. Is this real unity or just uniting against something? And that's a really good question. And I suspect it's going to be one that we're going to come back to in a number of ways over the course of this series, because I think a lot of what Paul has to say around unity will keep popping up. So I'm anticipating that as we explore that question a little bit, some of those themes will come back around over the course of this series. So let's get stuck into these questions. So I mentioned very briefly on Sunday that I have not preached through Romans before. I've preached bits and pieces from Romans, you know, something here from chapter 8, something from chapter 6, or whatever the case might be. But I've never systematically gone through the book of Romans. And I suppose there's been a handful of reasons why. I think I mentioned this very briefly on Sunday. I have always preferred, I think, the narrative sections of Scripture. So one of the reasons why I enjoy the Old Testament is because there's a lot of narrative in it. I think I like the Gospels for the same reason. There's a clear narrative context, which I think, well, I just prefer preaching, I think I would put it that way. I think that the narrative form is particularly helpful. I also, you know, I can't remember when I first heard this, but it was a long time ago, and it's been quite influential on me. Someone had said something to the effect that, you know, we tend to treat the epistles like the real meat of the gospel, right? Like if you really want to get stuck into the meat of faith, it's Romans, right? It's Galatians, it's Revelation, it's all that kind of stuff. And we kind of ignore the fact that we have the very words of Jesus in the gospel. Right? Yes, he didn't write the Gospels, but they are the recorded teachings and words of Jesus. And yet the Gospels tend to almost take a back seat to a book like Romans. And I remember that really resonated with me. You know, we follow Jesus, not Paul. And, you know, the idea that we would put so much emphasis on the epistles strikes me as, I think, has struck me for quite a long time as it's not a bad thing, but it's something just to be aware of, and so I think that has also led to my focus or my preference for the Gospels. Now, I think the difference between the Gospels and the Epistles is important, right? The Gospels outline for us the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, right? They give us his teachings. They talk about, you know, in particular for all of them, it's that last week, right? The lead up to his death and to his resurrection. That's obviously really important. And the Gospels taken up a really large percentage of their accounts. And then the epistles are by and large reflections on the implications of Jesus's life, death, and resurrection, right? Paul's letters, for instance, apply what the Gospels tell us about Jesus to specific situations. And I think that is a really valuable thing. So I don't want to downplay the epistles in the sense of saying they're not important or whatever the case might be. But they are reflections on the Jesus tradition, right? That we found in the Gospels, the Christ event, as it's sometimes described, you know, the things that Jesus has done. And so I think they serve slightly different purposes for us as well. And the epistles provide us, I think, with a bit of a model for how we can use the Gospels and the wider account of Scripture to apply those things to our lives together, which we'll get into in a little bit. So I think that's another reason why I think the doctrine of Romans, I think, has always been, I mean, it's pretty hectic, you know, talks about some of those really complex and controversial aspects of, you know, predestination and divine election and atonement and all sorts of stuff, right, that is found in them. And I've always, I think, found that a little dry to really kind of drill down into. I'm you know, strong believer that our doctrine, the things that we believe, are important to shape our practices. But at the same time, I've acknowledged that it's hard to preach sometimes. And that's why Scott McKnight's book really grabbed hold of me, I think, because it offered me an in into the why of the letter. So, you know, McKnight's argument, as I mentioned very briefly in the introduction, is that too often we treat Romans as this systematic outline of Paul's thought, and then there's some stuff at the end. I think I mentioned this on Sunday as well. There's a handful of things at the end, and that's great, but it's a bit of an appendix of sorts. The real stuff is at the beginning. And McKnight argued, and I think very persuasively, I mean, you know, again, as I said on Sunday, so persuasively that I have taken his advice and we're preaching Romans backwards. He's argued persuasively that Paul still had a pastoral concern that he was addressing, and that the doctrine, the theology, the outline of the gospel serves his pastoral purpose. A number of scholars have noted that there are all sorts of things missing from chapters 1 through 8 if it is a systematic theology, right? If it's an outline of everything that Paul believes, there's a whole bunch of stuff that he doesn't talk about. He doesn't talk really about, say, the Lord's Supper. Or worship. He doesn't talk about a number of components and things that we would want to address if he were dealing with everything that he believes. So I think that's also evidence that he has a pastoral concern even in that doctrinal piece. And so I think I approached it like McKnight says we approach it, a whole bunch of doctrine and then some stuff at the end. And I was like, not really keen on doing Romans. And I suppose, you know, at the heart of it, in many ways for me, it felt like Romans was a little bit overdone. You know, everyone preaches through Romans and blah, 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 blah. And so I think I was kind of resistant to that. But as I said briefly, I've been thinking for the last probably 18 months to 2 years that the time might be right to turn to Romans. And so it was in that turning to Romans that I encountered McKnight, and that really helped me in terms of, you know, getting my head around the book and what it is that we're engaged in. So I hope that makes some sense. I should probably just restate, as I did on Sunday and as I have in the life group resources, that we're not going to be preaching through Romans over the entire year. There are some really, really famous long series of preaching through Romans. I can't remember the fellow's name off the top of my head. He preached through Romans for like 3 years or something, like every Sunday. We're not going to do that. We're going to go through Romans in four blocks. So we'll do a block between now and Easter, and then there'll be another block in term two, and another in term three, another term four. So I think all up, we're going to end up doing about 17 or 18 weeks in the book of Romans, but we'll space that out so as to not tire ourselves out in the midst of all of the doctrine. So that's why I haven't preached Romans before, and hopefully that gives you a bit of a sense for why I'm at least a little bit excited to be preaching it at this point. So after Paul warns them about divisive and obstacle-placing people, he then says that he wants them to be wise about the good and innocent of what is evil. And so the question is, what does Paul mean by that, particularly in the church context? It seems that Paul is alluding to part of the Jesus tradition. So in Matthew's gospel, in chapter 10, and I should probably just pause here and say that the book of Matthew was probably not written by this point in time. Traditionally, scholars believe that Matthew's gospel was written later than the book of Romans, but that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were drawing on, you know, not just their personal recollections, although Matthew and John were both disciples, but they were kind of drawing on the Jesus tradition, the oral teaching that had become kind of the centerpiece of early Christian preaching and teaching. So traditionally, Mark's gospel has been connected to the preaching of Peter. Like to some degree, what we have in Mark is the stuff that Peter would preach, the stuff that Peter would talk about, the things that he felt were most important about Jesus and his teaching and his death and his resurrection. And so it's quite likely that some of the aspects of the Gospels were in circulation and very, very well known long before they got put to paper, shall we say, or papyrus, I suppose, to be more technical. And so Paul is reflecting on some early teaching. So in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus sends out the 12 on their first mission. I've noted before that this is really striking because in the Gospel of Matthew, the disciples still don't really know who Jesus is yet. It's before Peter's confession that he is the Christ or the Messiah, and before Jesus begins to teach about what that means in terms of his own death and resurrection. And yet he sends them out on mission before they really fully understand who he is, which I think is remarkably encouraging for all of us to remember that there is a place for us in God's mission. Really, really early on, we do not need to understand it all or have our heads around everything before Jesus wants to send us out on mission, as is evidenced here in with his disciples. And there's two kind of curious components to this in Matthew chapter 10. So there's the instructions that Jesus gives that seem contextually to make a lot of sense. Like he says, don't go to the Gentiles yet. Just go to the Jews, which makes sense because they were in Judea. And he talks about, you know, don't take too much stuff with you and look for the welcome of a home and those sorts of things and what they were to do. And then there's this kind of a shift and it suddenly becomes very future oriented. So in verse 16 of Matthew 10, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves, therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Be on your guard, you'll be handed over to the local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. And he goes on. So there seems to be, shall we say, a combination of teaching components that Matthew has arranged together because they're thematically linked. He sends the disciples out on their first mission, and then he talks about the mission that all disciples will have moving forward. And I think that context then, right, and the shift is wrapped around, you know, being shrewd as serpents, really curious connection to Genesis chapter 3, and as innocent as doves. So there's this real sense that has to do with the mission of believers, right? So Jesus is not just talking about that as a characteristic of believers in the church. He's talking about that in relationship to mission. That when they go out, and not just, shall I say, in mission, but in I suppose in their interactions with, you know, the synagogue rulers and the governors and the kings and the whole kind of bit. And that idea, I think, is what's picked up by Paul. That when Paul in chapter 16 is then talking about being wise about what is good and innocent about what is evil, I think what he's getting at is reminding them of their mission, of the missional character of the church. He's reminding them, I think, of their of the way in which they engage with their wider society. And that will actually become a little bit clearer as we work our way backwards through this through this last section of the book, chapters 12 to 16, because Paul has a bunch to say about how they live in relationship to secular authorities. He has something to say about, like, you should pay your taxes, right? So really kind of getting down to brass tacks about, you know, what it means. And so there's a real sense, and he talks about you doing everything you can to live in peace with those around you and whatnot. So I think that the missional component here and the innocence and the wisdom is not so much to do with the church context in terms of their relationships with each other or their unity together, although it's not as if it has nothing to do with that, right? The unity of the church is part of what enables their mission, which is why it's so important. But they are to be, you know, in terms of their own attitudes towards the surrounding authorities and powers, right? They are to be aware, right? Wise and innocent, shrewd and innocent in both cases. So I think that that's what Paul is getting at, reminding them of their missional component, sorry, of their missional character as a community of faith. Every divisive person recommends unity. Just agree with me. Paul does the same and rejects the heterodox. Is this real unity or just uniting against something? And as I mentioned at the in the introduction today, I think that this is a question that will take a variety of forms over the course of this series. I think that the question of unity and how we enforce it, I suppose, how we support or justify it, is actually a fairly important one. And I think we'll come back to it again and again and again, because there are a handful of things, particularly in the rest of the epistle, that kind of modify what Paul has to say about unity. So when he talks about the weak and the strong in chapter 14, he ends up talking about disputable matters, which I think is a tricky piece, right? What's disputable and what's not disputable? What's a salvation issue and what's not a salvation issue? How important are those disputable matters? And we'll try to deal with that in a few weeks' time when we get to that passage. Because I think it's a really critical passage in Romans in explaining what it is that Paul's about. I was thinking through the question, right? Every divisive person recommends unity. Just agree with me, and I would almost flip that a little bit. that kind of every division seems to begin with just agree with me, like I am right. And that contributes to division, because I don't think, like I get what the question's saying, but I don't know that every divisive person, like you think about politics today, it's really divisive, and it seems to be divisive on purpose, and they're not advocating unity, apart from us against them. Right, that becomes the that becomes the basis of that unity, and I think that. So I think part of that challenge is that unity of a certain group does bring distinction and division from other things. Right, I think that's part of the challenge of the unity of faith, because while we are one body, there are all sorts of differences of opinion, all sorts of differences of experience, differences of background, different emphases, like all sorts of stuff that, as I talked about briefly, that contains within it the seeds of division. And so, we have to try to figure out what, I think this is what I enjoy about the question, like what is real unity? Because Paul, I think, well, no, I'm not even saying that. I think Paul does reject certain beliefs and practices. So, his approach to those who wanted Gentiles to become Jews before they became Christians and fully submit to the law of Moses and the dietary restrictions and circumcision and Sabbath and all those sorts of things. Like Paul was like, they are absolutely wrong. They're destroying the church and have nothing to do with them. So now, I don't think he sees that as division. I think he sees that as the distinctions, right? Like these are the boundaries of our faith. Once you're outside of those boundaries, you're outside of the boundaries. So he's not seeking to divide as much as he is to discern and to distinguish, which is a really important part of of godly living. The law of Moses, for instance, in large part was given to the people as a framework to help them discern. The food regulations, right? I don't believe that God gave those to the Jewish people primarily for health concerns. That's never mentioned. But there is a sense that in their eating, right, like in their day-to-day habits of what they ate and didn't eat, they were to practice discernment about what they could and couldn't eat, what they should and shouldn't eat. That it was meant to be a bit of a symbol for them in their lives about the importance of distinguishing between that which was good and that which was best, between that which was clean and that which was unclean. And so that's a critical part of what we're called to distinguish and to discern and to draw some boundaries around what defines us as a people. That can, of course, become divisive. If, you know, you think about the Jewish the Jewish faith in the first century, beliefs around Jesus divided Jews, right? It divided them. And I think it's important, first of all, to recognize that Jews were not unified. It wasn't as if there was only one way to think and to be Jewish, and then, you know, Christians came along and busted that all up. There were divisions as evidenced in the various religious parties, you know, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes, who are not mentioned in Scripture, but were part of the early Christian movement, the Zealots. They all had very different ways of approaching their culture and their interactions with Rome and all those sorts of things. So I'm kind of dancing around some of the issues here, but I think that those are important, right? So Paul, I think, does want to discern and distinguish that which is the gospel and that which is not, right? That which is central to our faith and that which is not. When he gets into the disputable matters around unity, which I think is, you know, in the context of the letter, this is the, you know, this is the stuff that I think Paul, as we'll see, kind of takes a this and that approach, like a both and almost. You know, he basically says to people who want to eat certain foods, he says, yeah, go for it. But people who don't, he says, that's okay. But essentially, those who do eat those foods should not judge those who don't, and those who do eat those foods should not look down on those who do. So essentially, you're both right. He says, figure it out. It's a very complicated way to do unity. I think we'd prefer just saying this is right and that's wrong. This is what we do and that's what we don't do. I think we have an inherent desire for unity, I think, you know, and that sense of clarity around what we do and what we don't do. So I think that Paul does reject those things that are not true to the gospel, because he sees the gospel as powerful to unite. And yet, of course, even in that statement, Paul recognizes that there are going to be disparate people, disparate ideas that somehow in their diversity contribute to the unity of the church and to the benefit of the church. And so I think he tries to hold these things in tension a little bit. You know, I've mentioned H. Richard Niebuhr's work before, Christ and Culture, and the various approaches to cultural issues and whatnot. You know, then sometimes it's the right thing to do to reject something, right? To draw a stark line. In other times, it's appropriate to embrace what we're finding around us and to incorporate that into the church. In other cases, though, we have to hold some things in tension. And I think Paul does that a little bit with these disputable matters. And I think that's one of those things that's going to come up again and again in this series. Like, what is a disputable matter and what's not disputable? Now, when it comes to doctrine in particular, like, what's the core of it? What can we not deviate from, lest we cease to be Christians? You know, what's the tongue-in-cheek line? You know, you call yourself a Christian. Well, you know, there are certain things, I think, that define Christians. And those include beliefs and some practices. And I think we have to grapple with them. So I'm not sure I've answered the question much at all, to tell you the truth. I think Paul is more concerned. Paul is convinced that the gospel is what brings unity. That's what brings unity. Now, he is a servant of the gospel. And so, you know, he, as one of the apostles, has some authority in terms of the explanation and description of the gospel. But it's the gospel itself. It's the work of the Spirit in our faith in Christ that unifies us. And so there is a sense for Paul that it's not about arguing people into the body of Christ. It's about living out the reality of what we believe the gospel does. And so Paul is often, I think, far more interested in the ethical implications than he is in the doctrine. Although the doctrine is important because it shapes our behaviors. And as I said, I think that we'll keep coming back to this question around unity. And I think there'll be a variety of takes on this question because it is pretty critical to what it is that Paul is on about and what it means for us to be unified. You know, just even as a community of faith, let alone as one Baptist church amongst many, or as one denomination amongst many, or as one local expression as part of a global movement. What does it mean for us to be unified is a huge issue for us to grapple with. So trust that's been vaguely helpful as we launch into this series. I'm really looking forward to preaching through Romans backwards. And this coming week, we're going to move one section back from chapter 16 and be looking at the second part, really, of chapter 15. As I said, we'll be working backwards to Romans 12. And then in the second term, when we preach through chapters 9 through 11, we'll do that in order, 9, 10, and 11. And same with chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We'll do that as well. But looking forward, I hope you can join me and us as we gather together again on Sunday, whether that's on site or online. And until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.